in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program, and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Without a doubt, one of the most discussed books of 2019 is likely to be the book that we're going to be talking about for the next few minutes, a book titled All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. This is an examination of Donald Trump and his behavior towards women in a lot of different contexts. And of course, at the heart of this explosive story are a number of accounts of what Donald Trump is alleged to have done with a number of different women in a number of different scenarios, including some reports of ill behavior that have actually never been publicly aired before in this kind of fashion. But beyond that, this is also a book about how Donald Trump in general has treated women throughout much of his life. And that is really the heart and soul of this intriguing story. And it is co-authored by Barry Levine, an investigative reporter, and Monique El-Fezi, who is a journalist and author of a number of different books. And they, along with a couple of other collaborators, have crafted this book, which is just now off the press, again titled All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. Barry Levine and Monique El-Fezi, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So one of the problems with writing a book about a figure who is regarded in such starkly divisive terms as Donald Trump is sorting fact from fiction and sorting through what accounts are credible versus others, which are perhaps being aired for other reasons. Just talk for a moment about that challenge when we are talking about writing a book about somebody like Donald Trump and about intensely personal matters. What sorts of principles guided you in sorting through some of those complications?
I think that one of the things that we looked at, when you put all these stories together, the stories that we already knew about, the new stories, certain patterns emerge. And you really start to see how he behaves. So the stories that we included were those that matched the patterns that we knew were present in his life. There were stories we didn't put in the book because they just didn't feel credible to us. They didn't match the patterns. They were pretty outrageous. So we tried to, you know, to exert some judgment. Having said that, we are not a jury. We are journalists, women who felt credible to us. We included in the book, but it really is for readers to make their own assessment.
Mr. Levine, I wanted to ask you specifically about something that you say very early in the book in talking about how the book took shape and the experience of working with Monique and a couple of other collaborators. One of them is with the first name Whitney, and I'm forgetting her. Whitney Clegg.
That's correct.
Who has done some work for NPR, which is why her name kind of leapt out at me a bit. And one of the things you said was you appreciated her challenging you every day to do better. I thought that was just an intriguing turn of phrase. I wonder if you could be just a little more specific in terms of, kind of what is the difference between doing pretty well and doing better when it comes to putting a book like this together?
Well, Greg, there's no question. I surrounded myself with extremely competent journalists, Whitney Clegg, Lucy Osborne, who had been a producer for the BBC, who had done a documentary on Trump and women, Monique. I was surrounded by three incredible journalists, and we went, you know, our small team went off each day down, running down leads and so forth. Whitney particularly was here in New York. Lucy was in London. Monique was in Paris. And Whitney, I had the chance to work with every day, and she really challenged me to, you know, we would talk about the interviews that I had conducted, that she had conducted, and we would talk about the challenges were, you know, let's attempt to, you know, corroborate this account. Let's dig deeper into their past. Let's talk to friends of theirs who they may have told about allegations at a certain time. Because, Greg, as you said at the very beginning here, yes, you know, we're operating in a very polarized political climate. It was certainly important to ferret out each of these allegations and corroborate them individually. I'll tell you the story about just quickly one woman, Karen Johnson, who makes a groping allegation against Donald Trump that took place at a Mar-a-Lago New Year's Eve party many years ago. This is a woman who it took me 2 months speaking to her before she was fully comfortable in telling the full account of what occurred with Donald Trump. And when you really dig deeply with these women, you find that they've held on to these stories for many, many years out of fear of telling them at the time, because they were very afraid of being called liars. They were very afraid of being attacked in the media. And I have to say, through this process, this year-long reporting process, that we came across extremely brave and courageous women who wanted to share their stories because, at this point, it's important for the public, you know, to have as much transparency as we can for a man who wants to be president for another 4 years.
One of the things you promise early in the book is that we are not going to, we're going to hear not just from women who are either highly critical of Donald Trump and or insist that they have been wronged by him in one way or another, but that we would also hear from women who happen to admire Donald Trump and are supportive of him, and in a sense paint a picture that might be contrary to the central portrait that is offered up in your book. Can you just say a word about the care that you took to try to include those voices in your book, voices which, in a sense, suggest a different narrative from the one which ultimately the two of you certainly hold about who Donald Trump is and how he has treated women over the years?
And in an increasingly polarized America, and I would argue dangerously polarized America, I really didn't want to be picking a side. And I think it's very easy to dismiss for one side of the aisle, to dismiss the other side of the aisle. I grew up in a very conservative community. A lot of the people I grew up with are Trump supporters. They're evangelicals. I've written a lot about evangelicals. And I just thought it's important that we not sort of turn them into ciphers who, you know, are crazy and have no validity, because I don't believe that's the case. And so I wanted to give those women a voice, those people a voice. And not only that, I think that I didn't want to create a caricature of Donald Trump, right? We want to better understand the man, and to do that, you have to put everything in, not just the things, not just the facts or the stories that fit your narrative. I think that I wanted to create a more complex portrait of him than that. Hmm.
I was intrigued at one point when you were, in a sense, making this case that there also are these other possibilities in terms of how Donald Trump treats some women. And I think the word compartmentalize is utilized in terms of the way in which Donald Trump apparently has the capacity to treat some women very well, very respectfully, and other women he treats in a way that really just simply objectifies them in a way that most of us would find intolerable. Can you speak to that?
I think he has his own moral code, and I don't think it is the code that many of us live our lives by, but I think he has kind of these his own rules. And a friend of mine said to me, oh, it's like a mob code. And, you know, Trump grew up around the mob. He worked around the mob in New York. I'm not at all suggesting he's part of the mob. But I do think he has his own rules, and he can be very good to people. But people who cross him, men, women, but we see it more with women, you know, they're persona non grata to him, and they are, he's free to, he considers himself free to go after them in whatever way he sees fit.
Yeah, I'll also, talking about Trump in that way. At one point in the book, we outline the fact he was juggling three different women before he settled on Melania to be his third wife. There were two models, and there was a Norwegian heiress that he was involved with. And I interviewed one of the two models that he was seeing, and it was startling to me about how he... She discussed how he treated her versus the other model in the way that he took one out and he had one in private and so forth. There was no question that Donald Trump was able to, I guess you could say, multitask these relationships that he was having. And, you know, it's just startling when you hear the specific stories, because, you know, he was treating all of these women differently. And these were consensual relationships, I should point out. This wasn't part of his predatory behavior. But it was extremely important to also show what was going on in the rest of his life, in addition to, as you see through the book, the sprinkling of the inappropriate conduct which followed him over the course of many decades.
We're speaking with Barry Levine and Monique Elfezi about their newly published book called All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator. One of the things that you do is spend a little bit of time talking about Donald Trump's childhood. And you spend a particular amount of time talking about his experience of being sent off to military school for no apparent reason. I mean, sometimes a young man might be sent off because they are engaging in all kinds of behavior and are kind of uncontrolled and so on. And that does not seem to be the case here. And you appear to believe that this could be tied up in who Donald Trump is and the way in which he tends to treat other people and sort of the nature of his relationship. What do you think the connection is between some of the distance between he and his parents and what he is like now in terms of his relationships?
And these things, of course, are difficult to ferret out, never having spoken to the man, not being a psychiatrist, and no mental health professionals could ethically really examine the president, not having spoken to him. But we did, again, look for patterns and talk to psychiatrists about generalities. And there is a feeling that, based on his behavior, he does not form close relationships with people. And, you know, even before the military academy, it was suggested that his mother was she almost died in childbirth with his younger brother. It was suggested that that separation when he was only 2 years old would have had a traumatic impact on him. His military academy experience, you look at the patterns that he developed there, the behaviors he developed there, according to his classmates, and they really do still hold true today. You know, he had a propensity to mock people. He started calling, there was a girl he called a dog then, and you see him using that same kind of language today, even in the White House. Violence and verbal assault was kind of the lingua franca of the school. We see that carrying through today. And in terms of women, to me, I opened the book with this because it was so striking. His senior picture is him under the with the caption "Ladies' Man," and there's a woman in the book with him, and it turns in the photo with him. Excuse me, and it turns out he doesn't even know her. She is literally just a prop for that photo, and to me that was an illustration of his regard for women and how they really are accessories for him, and it's more about how they make him look than his relationships with them.
Your book is not just about Donald Trump's affairs, and I don't think we even need to call them alleged affairs, because in several cases he was pretty open about it, and there's really that is really beyond dispute. But beyond that, and then beyond some of the possible predation in which he has engaged, you also spend some time talking about his wives and these marriages. And one very curious fact is that Donald Trump does not tell a clear, concise, accurate narrative about any of his three wives in terms of how he met them. I mean, his account of that, of each of those encounters, will vary wildly over time. And most of us, although we don't remember everything with perfect clarity, most of us remember when we met the person we married. What is your suspicion of what is behind that, about why Donald Trump cannot be clear and, in a sense, honest about how he met the women who he ultimately married?
Well, I think if you look at some of his statements that he's making just about what's going on in the impeachment inquiry right now, you know, he's having some issues with cataloging his facts, just, you know, of things that have, you know, statements that he's made just over the past few weeks. So when you're talking about him going back and discussing things decades ago, you find that Donald Trump would say certain things about his wives to Howard Stern. He regularly engaged in kind of a running bio with Howard Stern for many years on his radio show. And then Donald Trump also wrote several books over the years, and you find conflicting accounts of how he described, you know, when he met his wives or what their relationships were at the time. And then, of course, as a journalist, and we're out to specifically find people from that period of time, you then get additional stories. One of the stories I think that, you know, we thought readers would find certainly relevant was exactly when he began seeing Melania Trump. There's conflicting accounts, and we point that out. You know, we certainly point that out in the book. You take, for instance, the account of his second wife, Marla Maples. He said that they had actually met in church or in front of a church on Fifth Avenue in New York. But in fact, when you dig into the story, you find out that it was a completely different account of what took place. So, you know, sorting fact from fiction was also a challenge for this book, in addition to bringing forward the allegations. Even working on the timeline that we have in the appendix of the book, it was important to, go back and check that every which way, because I wanted this to be, one of the intentions at the very beginning was that I wanted this to be a historical record of Donald Trump's life with women, not only his predatory behavior, but the marriages, the consensual relationships that he had, and of course, his views on women and his relationships with his father, his early mentor, Roy Cohen, who was a powerful attorney in New York. All of these things were extremely important. But at the end of the day, I wanted to have a very documented book that would hold up, because it is important. He is the president of the United States, and he wants to be president for another 4 years.
One thing that I found curious in reading about his first divorce, which of course was, I think in your words, a public spectacle like none other, that this, at least in the short term, really seemed to damage his reputation as a businessman. I think you write that this was a moment in his career when Donald Trump was no longer thought of as a serious businessman in the way that he had been before. Was that something that actually did any damage to him? And And is that also something that was changed in a sense for all time? I mean, from that point on, was he viewed in a different way and in a sense less as a serious businessman?
You know, that characterization came from Barbara Ress, who worked with him very closely, and she felt that that was a real turning point for him. At the time, also, he was trying to take part of his company public. And, you know, he and Ivana were the icon of the excess of the 80s together. She worked for the companies. They were really a unit. And before Ivana, he was just an upstart in New York, and so his legitimization in New York, she was part of that, and one could say she really contributed to that because, you know, he was a family man and he had kids and a wife. And so when all that fell apart, and they were very visible together even before there was any scandal in their marriage. So when all that fell apart, on the front pages of New York tabloids in spectacular fashion, with a young blonde who he's holing up in hotels and other properties on yachts, he became seen as a little bit of a buffoon. That's really when you saw this, the Donald Trump that we saw in The Apprentice, this kind of buffoonish showman. And Barbara Ress said that she thought that's when people stopped taking him seriously professionally. Over time, he hasn't changed so much. That has been okay. We've accepted that about him, and perhaps society has changed and is accepting that about more and more people. But his affair with Marla and the collapse of that marriage really does seem to have been a turning point. And he, according to press reports at the time, was worried that that would hurt his ability to take his company public. And many think that that's part of why he married her, because he just needed to salvage his own reputation.
Barry Levine, I am intrigued that your author's note at the beginning of the book is titled Bungalow 22. And you are taking us into a very particular place and describe it in some detail. Explain to our listeners what I'm talking about and why you thought this was a good place for your book to begin. In what way does this serve as an effective gateway into all that you share in the pages that follow?
Well, Bungalow 22 is one of the private bungalows at the Beverly Hills Hotel. Some of the bungalows there cost $17,000 a night to rent. And these private bungalows, really became a place that Donald Trump enjoyed going to. It was like a secret paradise for him to some degree. And as we found out in the early days of his marriage to Melania, he took three different women there, according to their accounts. One was Stormy Daniels, the public knows, adult film star. Another was Karen McDougal, who was a Playboy playmate, and Summer Zervos, who was an apprentice contestant. And all three of these women have discussed in interviews the fact that they were there with Donald Trump. And I wanted to start the book kind of to go behind the scenes as to what was this secret place. And I went there, and I walked down the pathway to where the private bungalow was, and I, you know, gave my thoughts and so forth. And it was important to feel the atmosphere of that place. What attracted Donald Trump to this private bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel? And what was interesting is that from what I found out and what I believe through my reporting is that Donald Trump was acting out something of a fantasy of the same type of life that Hugh Hefner had been living only a mile away at the famous Playboy Mansion in Los Angeles. Playboy Mansion and the Beverly Hills Hotel are only, a couple of minutes away. And for Donald Trump, the bungalow Bungalow 22 was his favorite. It was, for him, kind of the fantasy land that Hugh Hefner had lived in just a mile down the road. And it goes back to the person Donald Trump had been from the very beginning. It goes back to the military academy when Donald Trump and his classmates, and it was a boarding school, so they slept in barracks at night. They learned about women through Playboy magazine. They would, I write in the author's note that, Playboy for them was the ideal. Hugh Hefner for them was the ideal. And these classmates described to us how, of course, at the time when they were, teenagers, that, they would look at the Playboy and the centerfolds and so forth and have a vision of women. But as they grew up, they learned, they became mature and they became completely different in their lives and to learn to respect women and so forth. But for Donald Trump, it never changed. One of his biographers, David K. Johnston, had told me that Donald Trump has been living the year he was 13 for the past 60 years. And so Donald Trump has carried this vision of women from Playboy magazine, from the time when he was a youth, all the way up through all the decades of his marriages. And the bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel was something of a fantasy suite for him, where he was able to carry out behind closed doors in private these liaisons with these women. I should just point out that the relationships at that time with Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal were consensual. However, Summer Zervos, the Apprentice contestant, said that Donald Trump made unwanted sexual advances against her in a bungalow at the Beverly Hills Hotel, and she has since sued him for defamation because he has denied their encounter and has called her a liar. And that case is still making its way presently through the court system.
A last quick question. How is it, if Donald Trump has indeed engaged in such predatory behavior on so many different occasions, how is it that he has escaped, in a sense, a kind of ultimate indictment and punishment when we see all kinds of other celebrities have their careers crumble when such revelations are made? What is it that is allowing Donald Trump, in a sense, to escape the consequences of this kind of behavior?
No, I think, for starters, you say all these other people are having their careers crumble, but look how long that behavior went on. To me, what's shocking is that kind of predatory behavior in many industries with many people continues for decades and decades and decades. Trump, his reckoning would be more political because these weren't people like with Weinstein who were in power positions, who worked for him or who were dependent on him for their careers. And we see that politically there's very little consequence for him. His supporters support him despite a raft of allegations, which many of them dismiss, but many of them will acknowledge are credible. They just don't think it matters because he's doing what they want him to do politically. And in a legal perspective, aside from Summer Zervos, you can't really prosecute these cases because of statute of limitations. You know, these are very often he said, she said cases. So, shockingly, there seems to be very little consequence for Trump. And aside from the defamation lawsuit, very little prospect of consequence for Trump unless voters decide that they've had enough and hold him accountable in the next election.
Well, your book certainly explores all kinds of fascinating issues, including a really interesting discussion as to why white evangelicals have been willing to overlook some of the more unsavory aspects of who Donald Trump is and how he has lived his life. But we will leave it to our listeners to explore your book in greater detail. Again, it's titled All the President's Women, Donald Trump and the Making of a Predator, published by Hachette, and the authors Barry Levine and Monique Elfassi. I thank both of you for joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about your most intriguing book. Best wishes to you.
Thanks, Greg.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to The Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, you're going to be hearing a brief yet illuminating conversation about brain tumors and about some of the extraordinary technological breakthroughs that have revolutionized the way in which doctors and surgeons can both diagnose and treat such tumors. My guest is Dr. Alfredo Quinonos Hinojosa, who is a neurosurgeon and chair of the Department of Neurologic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida.
tell us, sir, about some of the extraordinary breakthroughs that have occurred in recent years that make possible better diagnosis and treatment of brain tumors. I am especially interested in the usage of advanced imagery and even virtual reality. What are some of the most important ways in which these kind of technologies are being brought to bear?
Well, thank you very much, Greg. This is a very important question in the diagnosis of brain tumors. It doesn't matter what the brain tumor is, whether it's what we call a cancerous brain tumor or a benign brain tumor. I say that over the last two decades, you know, in the 70s, starting with CT scan, but then in the 80s with MRI, but then over the last two decades, there's been more and more utilization of imaging technology that allow us to go into the operating room and not only have something like a GPS system, already that allows to understand where the brain is in relationship to a tumor, where the tumor is in relationship to veins, arteries, nerves, and function, like ability to move your hand, your ability to speak, your ability to understand. So now we can go into the operating room and have a map, a layout of the land. So that way we do our surgery and cause the least amount of damage into a human brain that requires to be fully functional, of course. And then couple that with the intraoperative utilization of things like the intraoperative MRI that allows us to take a picture even before a high definition MRI that allows us to do and have an idea before we leave the operating room. On top of that, you mentioned the issue of virtual reality. I would say that the Mayo brothers, 153 plus years ago, they said that there's no reason why we should learn to do surgery in the human brain or the human body, because nowadays the technology allows us to do surgery even before we go into the operating room through virtual reality to 3D bioprinting. Not only can we understand where those dangerous spots are, where is that vein? Where is our artery? Where is speech? Ability to move your hand, your ability to open your eyes, your ability to see. So that way when you go in, you create a safe passage and you minimize injury to any of these structures. And now you can even print these models and hold them in your hand and be able to do that surgery before you go into the operating room. And of course, you can use this technology nowadays and incorporate it into your surgical planning. So that way, when you are navigating the brain live, you're also getting an image. It sounds like a movie out of a superhero movie where you get to use this technology, but that's where we are today, and it is extraordinarily advanced, Greg.
Right. It's not science fiction anymore. It is science reality. One of the points that comes up again and again in what I have read about this is that much of this is about avoiding complications. And, of course, one can well imagine when we're talking about an organ as important as the brain, how even minor complications might lead to really terrible results. What kind of complications are we talking about that can be much more readily avoided utilizing this kind of technology?
Well, I would say that, as you know, the brain is still the unexplored frontier. One of the things that we have done over the last few years that I've been here at the Mayo Clinic in Florida is we created a multidisciplinary team that allows us to keep the patients awake and comfortable in the operating room so that way we can map their function. So if a tumor is near the speech area, not only your ability to produce speech, but your ability to understand speech. Imagine if you, in your attempts to try to take a tumor out, which, by the way, sometimes those tumors don't look different than the normal brain. So you have to make a decision. How much can you truly cut out of the brain? For us, keeping the patients awake allows us to understand where motor function is, ability to move your hand, leg, face, whatever it is, and be able to resect those tumors or preserve speech, you know, production, understanding of speech. So we have very effectively, you know, avoiding complications that are devastating. Imagine if you are a lawyer and your life is made out of making arguments in a oral or written form, and suddenly not being able to do so has a major consequence on a patient's life. Or imagine being a radio announcer or a brain surgeon like myself, and an inability to move your hands and to do things. It doesn't matter sometimes if you're taking tumors that are benign. If you cannot care for the normal brain, just the minimal amount of the wrong vessel being taken, the wrong vein being coagulated, can lead to devastating consequences for patients. So our goal is always to avoid that.
And quickly, the technological breakthroughs that we're talking about, of course, are not just part of the whole matter of treatment and surgery, but also I should think for diagnosis, we are in a much better position to better diagnose brain tumors because of some of this new technology.
Undoubtedly, Greg. Think about this. You know, nowadays, a patient comes in, I have an idea even before I go into the operating room as to what kind of tumor he or she may have, so that way I can tailor my surgery. Now, of course, at the end of the day, that tissue that we send from the operating room to a neuropathologist, you know, and then they tell us, this is what I think it is. It's extraordinarily vital information. But we know through functional MRI that that technology allows us to understand how a tumor may be affecting already parts of the brain that are crucial. So that way we can tailor our therapy. So this technology, as you said at the beginning, is no longer science fiction. It's a reality, and we're using it. And I think the next decade is going to be even more exciting with the use of artificial intelligence, machine learning that is being already incorporated in diagnosis and therapies. Just think about that. So the future is bright, and I always tell our patients, always have hope that we're going to make it better and better for our future generations.
Dr. Alfredo Quinonos Hinojosa is the chair of the Department of Neurologic Surgery at the Mayo Clinic in Jacksonville, Florida. Doctor, thank you so much for your good work and for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes.
Thank you, Greg, and thanks to your audience for listening to this.
Bye-bye.
And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about some ways in which young people can think in more meaningful ways and maybe more practical ways about what to do with the rest of their life, and in particular, the way in which they might really try to lay the path for whatever career they might ultimately pursue. And perhaps it is a young person who really doesn't have a very strong, clear idea about what that career should be, what they might enjoy doing. This is a book written for that kind of young person. It's titled Careering, The Pocket Book Guide to Exploring Your Future Career. It's published by Morgan James. And its author, Tamara Raymond, has been a consultant for many, many years, working with a wide variety of companies and with various employees. And she has some thoughts on what can be helpful for young people who are kind of pondering what to do with the rest of their lives. And we're going to speak with her for the next few minutes about her new book, again, called Careering. Tamara Raymond, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
So tell us what is behind this term careering, which is the title of the book. And it sounds like it is a concept that is worth exploring.
It definitely is. And the reason it's careering, it's because it's all about taking action and doing. So getting out there and trying different things. And that really is the premise of the entire book, giving a step-by-step guide that includes doing research or taking some kind of action to furthering wherever they are on that career journey. And it's just that, a journey. You know, some people might have an idea of what their interests are. Some might have no clue. But it starts by having them look at what your interests are, you know, what comes naturally to you. What do people come to you for? You know, then find out more about that and delve in a little deeper, looking at what careers are actually in line with some of those interests. and then looking for opportunities to try them out, so to explore. You know, you might think, okay, I'm doing great in English class, and I like it, it seems fun, I want to be a professional writer. And then you try writing professionally for, you know, a couple days even and decide, okay, this is not for me. Professional writing is not what I thought it would be. You know, it's not the same as the writing I do in English class. So, you know, or I want to be a scientist. That sounds fun. That's great. And then you realize, oh, I'm going to be in a lab all day. Maybe not so much. So you may have an idea or you may not, but either way, the book helps you tease out what some of those things might be that you're interested in, then encourages you to explore them and find different opportunities to do that while at the same time networking, meeting with people and making connections that can help you to further yourself on that journey. And that person could be your parent. You know, there are things that your parents can teach you or share that, you know, it's something that you may not have thought of, or it's something you didn't know about them, or even the network they have that could give you exposure, you know, to your career that you had no clue about. I mean, it happened to me while writing the book even. You know, I just happened to be having a conversation with my mother, letting her know that I was about to edit the book, and she goes, well, you do have, you know, there's your aunt who is the chair of an English department at a major university. You could have her read it. And I go, oh, I completely forgot about that. You know, we're all human. No matter where you are, there are things when you share what you're up to with people who you trust and who are just around you in your everyday life that you may not have necessarily readily thought of that could make a difference for you. Even I had one particular instance where I had a client, and she went to the same gas station every week. And the attendant, just like she does every week, asked her, you know, what she's up to, how she's doing. But in this particular instance, instead of saying, good, I'm great, and getting into her car, she usually did, she shared about this project that she was really excited about, this grassroots project that she really wanted to get off the ground. What she didn't know was that the attendant knew the governor, and she was able to put them in touch with each other, and her project exploded. Things went very well. So, you know, there are lots of tips and hints and, you know, step-by-step actions that people can take. But it also gives you varying notions to take a look at that you may not have done or even thought of before.
Right. And it certainly, I think, helps a young person realize that this is something that they do not have to sort out on their own. And probably a lot of young people feel like this is an answer that they just need to somehow pull out of their own soul and might be reluctant to reach out to others for help. And of course, your book really, I think, disavows them of that. Your book, of course, talks about other aspects of the process, tips on applying for internships and other sorts of opportunities. You even devote a whole chapter to honing one's interviewing skills. And this is the kind of thing that we probably don't stop to think about, that for a lot of young people, this may be the first time that they have ever been in an interview situation. What do you think are some of the most important things for a young person to think about when they are confronting this prospect of being interviewed for the first time?
One of the things that I've found, and this is with young people as well as adults, sometimes we get nervous. You know, we're about to go to an interview for the first time or the first time in a long time, and, you know, it's just a new or different experience. And so what I do is lay it out in a step-by-step process. You know, have them think through everything, what to do the day before, the logistics of the interview, how they're going to get there, what they should do when they get there, you know, even remembering to bring your ID in case say you have to show your identification to get into the building. So there's a lot of things that someone who is interviewing for the first time may not know or have thought of that is included in the book, including the fact that interviewing is a two-way street. So one of the things you want to do is also prepare questions that you want to ask the interviewer as well. And in the book, there are some sample questions to get you started on doing all that.
As you have talked to young people, what do you think have been the most significant misunderstandings that they have about what this whole search for a career is like? I mean, are there especially important kind of misunderstandings or misassumptions that you want people to sort of let go of?
Absolutely. I think the biggest one is having this idea that you have to have all the answers right now. And that can be very anxiety-inducing because you're making what most would say is one of the biggest decisions of your life, and you're doing it with limited information. You know, you haven't been in the work world. You don't really have a lot of experience with that. So the thing I really want them to get is that it's okay. It's a journey. You don't have to have all the answers, and you're not alone.
I appreciate the fact, too, that your book's last chapter is devoted to what someone should do once they have that first job. And I think a lot of people, if they would write a book like this, might not think to take it that far. Why did you want to include a chapter like that at the very end of your book?
I think because I have the advantage of, you know, going through a lot of this myself, in addition to being on the other end of the table, so to speak, in recruiting or as a human resources executive, I've seen what happens sometimes when, you know, somebody gets the job. They land the job, so they're excited. They finally got there, especially if it's in an area they're really excited and passionate about. And then there's the question, now what? You know, so to have them, you know, walk in with some level of comfort, knowing or having at least a general idea of here are some of the things I might want to do. Most companies will have like an employee handbook, an intranet, you know, that might give some guidelines on everything from, you know, what to do if something comes up that's a concern or what to wear. But one of the major things, in addition to all that, that I've found is a missing. Once people get that career or, you know, that particular job that they want to start out in, they forget about networking and other key things that could make a difference not only in their current role, but in order to continue to grow and develop and move forward with their career.
Mm-hmm. The book, again, is titled Careering, The Pocket Guide to Exploring Your Future Career. It's published by Morgan James, the author Tamara Raymond. Tamara Raymond, I thank you so much for writing a book that I think will be helpful to a lot of young people, and I appreciate you joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you. It was my pleasure, and thank you again for having me.
You're welcome. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Michael Dekel. Her father was one of hundreds of Jewish children in Poland who managed to escape with their lives and embark on a 3,000-mile journey that ultimately took them to the nation of Iran. Her book about that experience is titled Tehran Children, A Holocaust Refugee Odyssey. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. On Thursday, Martin McClendon will be joining me from the theater department at Carthage to talk about the upcoming fourth annual Vet Night of the Arts, which is going to be on Monday evening, November 11th. Friday's morning show will include a preview of this weekend's Carthage Philharmonic concert, Sunday afternoon, that is devoted to the music of three women composers. Support for The Morning Show comes from Carthage College, home of the Aspire program and its multifaceted approach to career preparation. The new program is designed to cultivate leadership and entrepreneurial skills while empowering each Carthage student to shape a custom career development plan from their first days on campus. Learn more about the Aspire program at carthage.edu/aspire. We remind you that The Morning Show is now available as a podcast on all of the major podcast platform providers, including Apple Podcast, Google Podcast, and Spotify. Be sure to look for The Morning Show.